From EWTN, the Global Catholic Network, this is EWTN News Nightly.
And thank you for being with us on the Solemnity of the Sacred Heart. I'm Tara Mergener. We begin with a flurry of Supreme Court decisions today, which all came down. We'll take a look at three of the most crucial decisions from the nation's highest court as it wraps up its term. Topics ranging from birthright citizenship to age verification on porn sites and LGBTQ books in a Maryland school district. And that's where we begin. In a 6-3 decision, the court sided with parents seeking to withdraw their children from public school lessons featuring LGBTQ+ themed books. The justices said school officials in Montgomery County, Maryland, may not require children to participate in lessons that conflict with their parents' religious beliefs. Writing for the majority, Justice Samuel Alito says in part, quote, "We have long recognized the rights of parents to direct the religious upbringing of their children." He wrote, "And we have held that those rights are violated by government policies that substantially interfere with the religious development of children." In her dissent, Justice Sonia Sotomayor starts by quoting from a 1987 opinion describing public schools as at once the symbol of our democracy and the most pervasive means for promoting our common destiny. But that idea will become a mere memory, she argues, if children must be insulated from exposure to ideas and concepts that may conflict with their parents' religious beliefs. EWTN News White House correspondent Owen Jensen was able to directly ask President Trump today about the high court's decision in the press briefing room.
You could. Go ahead.
Sir, on the transgender ruling, the Supreme Court ruling that parents with religious objections can pull their kids out of public school lessons that use LGBTQ materials. Okay. Pam brought it up. Your reaction to that ruling today, sir?
I think the ruling was a great ruling, and I think it's a great ruling for parents. It's really a ruling for parents. They lost control of the schools. They lost control of their child. And this is a tremendous victory for parents.
All right, joining us now is the attorney who argued the case. Eric Baxter is vice president and senior counsel at Beckett. Eric, thank you so much for joining us. Your reaction to the ruling?
The First Amendment did its job today and vindicated the right of parents to direct the religious upbringing of their children. When you send your kids to public school, you don't expect them to be exposed to indoctrination that tells them that doctors guessed at their sex when they were born, that teaches them that their pronouns can change multiple times a day, or that introduces them to concepts you would only find at a pride parade. So this really restores the right of parents to make the decisions about how and when these kinds of topics are taught to their children.
And what sort of implications do you see this case having for parents' rights nationwide?
Yeah, it really benefits parents of all political stripes, of all religious persuasions. Anybody might be in a situation where they disagree with something that's taught in their schools, and they would have the right now to let their child opt out. It's really a great way also to promote pluralism, allowing people to disagree. Even when we have strong disagreements, we can respect each other by allowing each other to live out their own beliefs.
And what happens next for the students in Montgomery County?
Hopefully more opportunities in school, more freedom to live out their faith, even in a public setting.
All right, Eric Baxter, thank you. In Free Speech Coalition, Inc. versus Paxton, it was another 6-3 decision split along ideological lines. It upheld a Texas law that requires certain commercial websites publishing sexually explicit content that is obscene to verify that visitors are 18 or older. The majority ruled that the lower court applied the appropriate level of judicial review when evaluating the constitutionality of the age verification laws. It added the law survives a more heightened form of judicial scrutiny. In the majority opinion delivered by Justice Clarence Thomas, the court determined that HB 1181 was not unconstitutional under the free speech clause of the First Amendment. The opinion affirmed that the power to require age verification is within a state's authority to prevent children from accessing sexually explicit content. In her dissent, Justice Elena Kagan argued that while it was a reasonable goal to protect minors online, but what if Texas could do better? What if Texas could achieve its interests without so interfering with adults' constitutionally protected rights in viewing the speech HB 1181 covers? That is the ultimate question on which the court and I disagree. And here to join us with the latest on that case is Andrea Pasciotti, Bayer legal analyst for EWTN News. Andrea, thank you so much for being here. Your reaction to this ruling from the court today?
Yeah, Tara, thanks so much for having me on. You know, this decision was Clarence Thomas at his best, right? He was really giving lower courts a guideline on the proper judicial standard for evaluating these kinds of cases. He again reinforced that states have a legitimate interest, an important government interest in protecting children from obscene images, and that these kinds of age verification requirements really only had an incidental burden on adults' free speech rights. It was great. The dissents, of course, are going to clamor that this is an interference with the First Amendment. But I think that Justice Thomas and the five other justices that joined him were clearly convinced that it just doesn't, and this is a first step in protecting our children from the invidious scourge of online porn.
And what implications do you think this is going to have nationwide now?
Yeah, Tara, there are 24 states in the country that have these age verification laws. So this is going to be able to insulate them from challenges, but be mindful that the challenges will continue to come. And this decision is going to help lower courts to be able to verify and hold up any kinds of restrictions so that children aren't exposed to these images.
And obviously very important this decision is when it comes to protecting children.
Absolutely.
Andrea, thank you so much. Another big ruling today came in the case of Trump versus Casa. In a 6-3 decision, the Supreme Court backed President Trump's request for a partial stay of the injunctions aimed at blocking the administration's ban on birthright citizenship. The president was quick to celebrate what he called a monumental victory. EWTN White House correspondent Owen Jensen joins us now with more. Owen.
Tara, President Trump also called it a giant win and an amazing decision. He thanked the justices and held a news conference in the briefing room.
Just moments after the high court announces its ruling, President Donald Trump expresses his satisfaction.
It's been an amazing period of time this last hour. There are people elated all over the country. I've seen such happiness and spirit. Sometimes you don't see that, but this case is very important.
The president also says he was elected on a historic mandate, adding,
but in recent months, we've seen a handful of radical left judges effectively try to overrule the rightful powers of the president.
The attorney general also addressed the ruling.
Americans are finally getting what they voted for. No longer will we have rogue judges striking down President Trump's policies across the entire nation.
And Pam Bondi credits one justice in particular.
Today in the 6-3 opinion, Justice Barrett correctly holds that the district court lacks authority to enter nationwide or universal injunctions.
Still up in the air tonight, birthright citizenship. The USCCB says the Catholic Church opposes its repeal because, quote, it would render innocent children stateless and create a permanent underclass in U.S. society. At the White House, Owen Jensen, EWTN News Nightly.
All right, and joining us now is Carrie Campbell Severino, president of the Judicial Crisis Network. Carrie, great to have you back. On social media, you said this ruling is a step toward shutting down judicial activists. What do you mean by that?
Well, what we've seen is an explosion in recent years of the use of universal injunctions. So cases where judges will not just say that you have to, the people in the case have to stop doing whatever is illegal against each other, but you can't do that anywhere. So in this case, as soon as Trump puts out any executive order, there's a judge somewhere, and they know how to pick the courts that they think are going to rule in their favor, that's going to say, no, you can't enforce that as to anywhere in the United States. Now it's clear. Perhaps the states that bring this case, maybe they can have it held in their state while litigation proceeds. Perhaps the people who brought the case, it might not be enforced as to them, but it can't be one court decides for the entire nation until it really comes all the way up to the Supreme Court.
So help us unpack what comes next for birthright citizenship. How do you see this all playing out?
Well, I think the first step here is that there are a lot of, this case and many others, there are a lot of universal injunctions that are going to have to be removed by the courts, which is going to allow many of President Trump's executive orders and other actions to go forward. With respect to birthright citizenship, the case is going to continue. It will just be have to continue, again, perhaps with respect to the states that have sued in this case, or in the individuals. He might not be able to enforce his order against them, but elsewhere in the country, the order will go into effect. The decision does say, however, that there is going to be a 30-day window before that happens, and the court proceedings will continue in that process. So it's also possible we'll have further court decrees on this topic before that 30 days is up.
All right, Carrie Campbell Severino, president of the Judicial Crisis Network, thank you for joining us. All right. The U.S. and China reach a deal on rare earth minerals. The accord will make it easier for American firms to obtain magnets and other minerals critical to microchip production. Beijing says the exports are in return for the cancellation of certain measures. Rare earth minerals are essential for electronics, fighter jets, and more. The International Energy Agency says China controls about 90% of rare earth processing. President Trump also says he is ending trade talks with Canada. At issue is Canada's tax on U.S. technology firms. President Trump calls it, quote, a direct attack on our country. The taxes are set to take effect on Monday. They will also apply retroactively, meaning at the end of the month, U.S. companies are set to owe Canada $2 billion. Congo and Rwanda sign a peace deal brokered by the United States. The accord was signed today in Washington, D.C. by the foreign ministers of both countries. Secretary of State Marco Rubio witnessed the signatures. The agreement is set to end decades of bloody conflict. The U.S. also will gain access to critical minerals needed for much of the world's technology. And we have a lot more still to come on EWTN News Nightly, including damage report. Lawmakers want to know just how effective the U.S. strikes on Iran were. We're going to speak to an expert. And it was a jubilee unlike any other. We speak to a new priest who was ordained by the Pope himself. Fallout from the U.S. attack on three of Iran's nuclear facilities is still a hot topic on Capitol Hill. Lawmakers received classified briefings from intelligence officials on the damage in the future of Iran's nuclear program. Capitol Hill correspondent Eric Rosales joins us with a reaction from both sides. Eric.
Well, good evening, Terry. Yes, lawmakers came away from these briefings with very different impressions of the strike. Basically falling on long party lines, Republicans said intel officials confirm Iran's nuclear program was, quote, severely damaged and key sites were destroyed. But Democrats claim it's still too early to reach a definite conclusion.
President Trump said that the nuclear stockpile was completely and totally obliterated. I did not receive an adequate answer to that question.
We have struck a major blow alongside our friends in Israel against Iran's nuclear program that is going to make America safer, our friends in the region safer, and protect the world from the risk of an Iranian nuclear weapon.
But others contend it's too early to draw any conclusions.
Anybody who says we know with certainty is making it up, because we have no final battle damage assessment.
Democrats also stress the need for diplomacy as the only option to end Iran's nuclear ambitions.
The only path forward is diplomacy. And I just have not heard a realistic path from this administration about diplomacy. Of course, all of us would love a diplomatic agreement.
Senator Lindsey Graham countered, not when you're dealing with a terrorist nation.
He just said he wouldn't have done it. You know, I like Senator Murphy, but that's absurd. You got a chance to set back the nuclear ambitions of a religious Nazi by years, and you don't take it? That's how World War II started.
Some House Democrats criticized the president, saying he went beyond his authority.
There's no doubt that the president has self-defense authority, but that threshold, in my mind, has not been met. Right? There has to be an imminent risk against U.S. persons in U.S. facilities in order for the president to do this without congressional authorization.
After the briefing, House Speaker Mike Johnson says Iran must make the next move.
We now need Iran to engage with us in direct, good faith talks, negotiations, not through third parties, not through other countries. They need to sit down at the table with us and ensure that this peace is truly lasting.
Lawmakers were also asked about the leak of classified damning information from an assessment report. Lawmakers on both sides of the aisle agree that leaks like this should never take place and those involved should face punishment. At the Capitol, Eric Rosales, EWTN News Nightly.
Eric, thank you. Joining us now is David Albright, the president of the Institute for Science and International Security and a former nuclear weapons inspector. David, thanks for being here. Aside from party lines, why do lawmakers have such differing interpretations of the briefings on the damage to Iran's nuclear facilities?
Yeah, it is. It's political for sure, because they're getting the same information. And of course, President Trump has staked out a very kind of rhetorically extreme position, but I think there's a common agreement that the nuclear, let's say, this uranium enrichment infrastructure was essentially destroyed, and that's the infrastructure that would allow Iran to make more centrifuges or to operate them, and so I think that's agreed upon. The process to make nuclear weapons themselves was certainly damaged. Everyone can see it. Up to 14 nuclear scientists who were leaders in that kind of nuclear weaponization program were killed by Israel. And it's damaged many facilities, or actually destroyed many facilities associated with making the nuclear weapon itself. Where I think the parties are really fighting is over this question of residual stocks of enriched uranium, particularly stocks of highly enriched uranium, the 60% material. And it's and the some think, it was in Fordow chambers collapsed, you can never get it again. Others think, no, it's been hidden away. So I think what the fight is over is these stocks of enriched uranium, and then some unknown number of centrifuges that Iran made but didn't put in Fordow or Natanz, and where are they? And so I think, and some emphasis, so the emphasis is just placed differently, and some worry that yes, Iran will never build up a centrifuge program like it had before the attack for years to come, but it could break out with the enriched uranium at some point of its choosing, maybe not in the immediate future, but a year from now, 2 years, and make weapon-grade uranium sufficient for a bomb and reconstitute or refashion its nuclear weaponization program and succeed in getting something. So I think where there is, hopefully there's convergence, is that the negotiations coming up with Iran should be tough, and it's about ending their enrichment program. And in that process, we need to know where are the stocks, how much does Iran have. If it claims it's in third Fordow, then there has to be a mechanism to verify that. And so I think where I think we need to come together is on these upcoming negotiations to demand a good outcome. And if Iran doesn't agree, then after all, it's a ceasefire.
Yeah, and your Institute, David, for Science and International Security has obtained several high-resolution photos of the damage done. Let's take a quick look at a couple of these. These two images show the Fordow nuclear enrichment site with a map of the facility overlaid. So quickly, what can you tell us about the damage done specifically here?
Well, and we've done this assessment that you can't just take a bunker buster and have it go through 200 feet of mountain. So they were looking for vulnerabilities, and we felt that the ventilation system was a vulnerability, and that turned out to be correct. I mean, we didn't fully understand the ventilation system, but we understood there was definitely one major system, and then. We thought there was another vulnerability that turned out to be another ventilation duct. And so what you have is the ability of these bunker busters, and they're multiple on each shaft, ventilation shaft, just can break through. And they're essentially going through air. They're not going through the mountain. I'm exaggerating a little bit. There's structures in the ventilation shaft. But it showed, and we proposed this a week or two ago, and in order to show that it was credible that the site could be attacked. And then after the attack, it was credible. It could have done a lot of damage. And I think that debate is now over. But it was quite heated that people said, no, these ventilation shafts don't exist.
Right.
And so we feel vindicated on that level and more confident and have an expectation that the facility was severely damaged.
Absolutely. David, so many questions left. David Albright, President for Institute for Science and International Security, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Up next on EWTN News Nightly, uplifting messages. What Pope Leo said to seminarians and priests in a series of events this week in Rome. Plus, one diocese in the United States nearly sets a record with its ordination class. We're going to tell you where. Got good news from the Catholic Diocese of Arlington, Virginia. It recently ordained the second largest class of new priests in its 50-year history. There were 12 members of the class that was ordained by Bishop Michael Burbridge last week. The new priests are ages from 28 to 56. They include former engineers, a one-time government lawyer, a tech company founder, and two future military chaplains. Several said they were simply looking for more than what they had in their pre-seminary lives. Pope Leo XIV delivered a series of uplifting messages to bishops, priests, and seminarians this week in Rome. It was part of a week-long initiative dedicated to the clergy. EWTN News Vatican correspondent Valentino Di Donato has more.
This week, more than 6,000 seminarians, bishops, and priests from five continents have come to Rome for 5 days of events to celebrate their jubilee during the Holy Year. Prayer, concerts, jubilee pilgrimages through the Holy Door, masses, and meetings with the aim to renew and deepen the commitment for the vocation.
Reverend Gilbertica.
EWTN News sat down with Reverend Gilbertica, a seminarian from Ghana, preparing for his ordination with Pope Leo XIV, a culmination of his calling that began when he was a boy.
I am actually living an emotional moment, so it's difficult, but I'm happy. I'm happy. I have a lot of emotions. And it's something wonderful to think of being ordained by the Pope Leo. I think it's a special gift God is giving me and the other brothers who are also going to be ordained.
Events also included a series of meetings between seminarians, priests, and bishops with Pope Leo XIV. Who met with priests, showing the global reach of the participants.
Chicago! Il vescovo è uomo di speranza.
The bishop is a man of hope, since faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. Especially at moments of difficulty in people's lives, the bishop, by this theological virtue, helps them not to despair, not simply by his words, but by his closeness. When families are greatly burdened and public institutions fail to provide adequate support, when young people are disillusioned and fed up with empty promises,
this morning the Holy Father ordained 32 new priests, including Reverend Gilbertica.
Per alcuni dei presenti poi,
the task and pastoral mission of the priest, the Holy Father emphasized, must prevail, casting a gaze on the most vulnerable, especially in divisive times like these.
In un tempo di grandi e terribili conflitti,
in this age of vast and devastating conflicts, that the love of God has no limits, we are called to let ourselves be embraced and shaped by that love, and to realize that in God's eyes, and our own as well, there is no place for division and hatred of any kind.
Odi di alcun tipo.
As Reverend Gilbertica begins his pastoral mission, he tells us he feels ready to instill hope and faith in the parish where he will minister.
It's a difficult task because generally where there is war, it's difficult to bring it to an end. But however, what we can do is to continue to promote the little peace that we have so that people will gradually get converted, because where there is peace, then we can grow and work together as a people of faith. And gradually we begin to dialogue also with those people who are in crisis and to help them with our prayers and the little we can do.
In Rome, Valentina Di Donato for EWTN News Nightly.
And we thank you for watching tonight. Remember, you can follow us on social media, Facebook, X, and Instagram at EWTN News Nightly. I'm Tara Mergener. Good night and God bless.